Back a while ago, maybe when some of you were raising your children, James Dobson wrote a book, Dare to Discipline. Then he said, after discipline, hold your child in your arms and let him know that you love him. You have not chastened him in anger, you have done it in love. And that's a special time. Another word from that generation was a public announcement that said this: get hold of yourself before you take hold of your child. Good advice for some people who were not able to do that. Now, that's true in the physical family, but it's also true in the spiritual family. Paul chastened the Galatians. That's all we've seen so far. Paul saying, you people, what are you doing? You're foolish. I brought you the gospel of the grace of God, and look what you've done. Why, you're bewitched. Someone put a hex on you. And so everything he said has been very sarcastic. He's used his exhortation and confrontation to put a guilt on them. He also put a lot of logic, Old Testament illustrations, to help his Galatian friends to understand the danger they're in, that if they keep on going down this slippery slope of works law, then it's going to take them in the wrong direction. So if we stopped at the end of chapter 3, you'd say, man, Paul was a pretty mean guy. That's all he did was hammer on people. But no, as we come to chapter 4, we see Paul is doing something other. See, he didn't call them brothers before. He didn't call them anything good. But now he's going to call them brothers. We see a tenderness. We see him call them brothers. He call them, also in verse 19, he's going to call them my little children. That doesn't sound like the same guy in chapter 4 or chapter 3. It's almost as though we could call him this guy in the last three chapters. We'll call him Deutero-Paul, like they do with Isaiah. They say, oh, Isaiah wrote the first part, and then another guy, a second Isaiah, Deutero-Isaiah, wrote the last part. Almost that. But we know it's not that, because we find that Paul has another side to him, and we're going to find it. He kind of wraps his arm around these Galatians and says, oh, I want you to know, I'm becoming vulnerable to you because you are a part of me. So in this place, we're going to say Paul the man, not Paul the teacher, Paul the man, Paul the pastor, Paul the passionate lover of souls, see? And this passage starts with Paul's affection for the Galatians. You see it in your outline or even on the screen. In 12 to 16, he says in verse 12, the first part, he says, he has his plea, Paul's plea. He begins by writing, brethren, I urge you, become like me. I'm not commanding, I'm urging you, I'm exhorting you to be like me. For I became like you. That sounds like a little conundrum, doesn't it? Come like me because I came like you. No, I don't. It's, what he's saying is, become like me. How? Well, because I'm free from the law. I am free in Christ. Become like me. Because I became like you. Paul had been one of the Judaizers, not so much a Judaizer as a Pharisee, a Judaistic person, who went around and even threw people in jail. People were killed because of Paul's zeal for the law. And he said, no, I became like you. I became like Gentiles, no longer living under the law. It's irony that the one who did all of this has his people, the ones he led to the Lord, going back under that same kind of law that he had been freed from. Paul knows firsthand what it's like. He knows firsthand what it is to live in the misery and the bondage of the Mosaic law. He lived in it, and he was up to his neck in it. That was Paul, more than anyone else we know. So that was Paul's plea, be like me, because I became like you. And then we have Paul's problem in verses 12b and 13. He says in 12b, you have not injured me at all. And that's a little strange. People talk about different ways. What does that mean? It means this, means that. I think what it means is this. 12b goes with the following verses, not the preceding verses. He's saying, you have not injured me at all. And then he goes on to talk about, when I came to your place, when I came to Galatia, you didn't hurt me there. That's what he's talking about there, not back the other way. So he's saying, you did not hurt me when you put yourselves back under the law. He's not saying that. He's saying, rather, when I came to you with my debilitating illness, you did not treat me with contempt. Apparently, there was something in Paul's, whatever he had, there was something that had made him look strange. Maybe his eyes were watering, I don't know. I had a professor in college, can't think of his name now, but his eye bulged out. He looked strange, and he looked at you. I see that eye. His wife would write his sermons, his notes, real large, so he could see them, a little bit like me. Then he hold it up like this. When he preached in chapel, he would hold it like this. I don't think I ever had him for a class, but it was strange. But he said some really great things. He taught Romans, and he said some really fine things in Romans. Well, all I'm saying is there was something about him, about Paul, that was repulsive. And he says, you didn't hurt me. You didn't treat me with contempt because of that. And then verse 13, he says, and you know, because of my physical infirmity, I preached the gospel to you at the first. And I think, what do you mean, because of? I preached to you because of my physical infirmity. What does that mean? Again, they go all different ways on this. Here's what I think it means. Sir William Ramsay suggests, he's a great historian, he suggests that Paul had malaria combined with severe headaches. We talked about this in the book of Acts. But he had some kind of a malaria, and on the first journey, he left the wet lowlands of Perga, when he landed at Perga, remember, over on the mainland, and he left there to go up to the drier elevations of Galatia to Antioch. That's where he preached first, in Galatia. He preached there, and he says, because of his illness, that's where he was. He didn't preach in Perga, where he probably should have or could have. No, because of my illness, I preached there. I think that's what he's saying. And then he says to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 10 and 11, he says this, but you have carefully followed my doctrine, the manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, with love and perseverance, persecutions, afflictions, which happened to me at, hear this, Antioch, Iconium, Lystra. These are towns or cities in Galatia. And he says, what persecutions I endured, and out of them all the Lord delivered me. So Paul brought some of his afflictions with him, his eyes or whatever that was, and he received some more afflictions at the hand of these Jews in Galatia. So that was Paul's plea, to be as I am. And then there's Paul's problem in 12b, and then verse 14, 15, Paul's approval. And my trial, he said, which was in my flesh, you did not despise or reject, but you received me as an angel of God, even as Jesus Christ. What then was the blessing you enjoyed? Now, get what he's saying here. He's saying, you were so happy to have me there. Why was it? Why were you so happy to have me there at that time? What blessing did you receive from me? That's what he's saying. Because now you rejected me. That's his whole point. See, they didn't reject him because of his afflictions. They received him. Why? As an angel of God? Even as Jesus Christ? I haven't had that yet. Not likely to either, somebody said. Okay, fine. But his question was then, what then was the blessing you enjoyed? You treated me so well, there must have been some reason for doing this. And the answer he suggests is, it must have been the message I delivered to you, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Isn't that great? That's why they did it, because of his message. If we just listen to the message and forget the idiosyncrasies, oh, he's always reading his book. He can't memorize anything. Can't remember his own name. No, but it's the message, see? Not the way a person does it, not some of the little strange things that he does, but the message. It must have been that message. You liked me because of the message. I love that. And I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. Some believe that Paul needed the eyes, you know. His problem was in his eyes. He needed those, and so they would have given him their eyes if they could have. Of course, back then they couldn't. Nowadays they could. They probably wouldn't offer now because they have to do it. But whatever that disease was, some people feel that it was his thorn in the flesh. Remember Paul said, I went to heaven and I saw all kinds of things and I can't utter that. And because of that, lest I should say I'm so exalted and write some book and be on channel 45 over there, sell my book about what heaven's like. Oh, there really is a heaven. Because this little kid had a dream. There's a heaven because the Bible says so. All right, anyway, that's Paul said, I went to heaven. So lest I should go around telling everybody and get a tent and start healing people, lest I should do that, God gave me a thorn in the flesh. Doesn't describe what it is. We don't know. But something, it's a messenger of Satan. He lets Satan do it to remind him, don't tell what you saw. So some people think, okay, that must be what it was. I don't know. But that would help us if we understood in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 11, he says, he took the pen from the scribe. You know, Paul didn't write his letters. He had somebody write for him. He dictated them. And he had his trusty office assistant. No, his office executive that helped him. He wrote it down. At this point in Galatians chapter 6, verse 11, Paul took the pen and said, let me write the rest of it. And here's what he wrote. You see what large letters I have written to you with my own hand. Well, what large letters? Why large letters? We'll talk more about that when we get there. But I think what he's saying is that I had to write large because my eyesight had to be able to see what I was writing. That seems to be what it was. So he wrote large letters. Then he says in 2 Thessalonians 3:17, he says, I do this in all my letters. He says this in 3:17 of 2 Thessalonians. The salutation of Paul with my own hand, which is a sign of every epistle I write. You find Paul's own handwriting in it. Well, you don't always see that, and we have it all printed up so you don't see Paul's hand. But that's what he says. I sign every letter in case somebody tried to do a forgery. So here in Galatians 6, he's writing large letter, maybe because of his eyesight. Now, after all this, he says, you're throwing your freedom away because of some men who don't care about you. I cared about you. You saw that I did. You received me as an angel and even as Jesus Christ. And then, because I cared for you, I had my arms around you the whole time. And yet you go off after some other people into bondage, and those people don't care a whit about you. So, Paul's plea, Paul's problem, Paul's approval. Now, Paul's persuasion. He says, have I now become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Verse 16. See, looking at the facts, Paul had come to only one conclusion. Here are the facts. I told you the truth. It's a little syllogism. It's not logical, but it's a syllogism. I told you the truth. Now, I am your enemy. What's the conclusion? Well, I became your enemy because I told you the truth. That seems to be what he's saying. He's saying, I can't understand what you're doing. Why would you do this to me? Now, that's Paul's affection. He loved the Galatians. But then we also see Paul's allegiance to them. Because love, if you love somebody, you have allegiance toward them. Now his allegiance is in verses 17 to 20. He talks, first of all, about the artificial loyalty of the Judaizers. They say they love you, but they're not. They, he says in verse 17, they zealously court you, but for no good. They want to exclude you that you may be zealous for them. Now, the Judaizers were zealous. Is there anything wrong with being zealous? No. No, of course not. It's okay to be zealous. They were zealous. They really worked at it. Like the false cults of our day. While you're sitting here, the false cults are going through your neighborhood, knocking on doors, because they know the believers, the Christians, are at church. So we're knocking on doors and finding the people who are not church people, people who are probably not believers, they're after them. So that's where they are. And they're very zealous. We could use that kind of zeal in giving out the Word of God, telling people about Christ, going to door to door, whatever it takes. I don't think we have to go door to door, frankly. People come to us. They come to us every day. I was in my office Friday. Two men had been working on this slab out here. They came in, sat down, and they wanted his check. We had a little small talk, and what are they going to do? Get up and run out? I still got their check. So we started talking. And one of them was very serious. So I asked them the question, what would you do? If God said to you, why would I let you into my heaven, you know, a la James Kennedy? It was a good chance for them to feel the truth. One of them, I'm convinced, believed on the Lord. Right there. It was amazing, the opportunity. The other one, not too sure, but I've got a chance to be with him later. But there he is. What I'm saying to you is that people come to us. If we'll watch for them, people will come to you. People are around you all the time. Always an opportunity if we look for it. Ask the Lord to open up opportunities for us. Be zealous. See, nothing wrong with that. These people were zealous. But these were doing it for their own evil purposes, not for your good, he says. Their purpose was to alienate you, to lock you out, to lock the Galatians out from Paul's teaching, from Paul's influence. They're going to say, okay, you come with us. And what would the cults do the first thing they got hold of you? What they would do? Now, don't go back to that church. Don't talk to your friends. Just come on over and meet with us. You know, they mother you. They smother you. That's what cults do. And that's what these Judaizers had done. Got them all so that they could lock them out of Paul's place, and then put them into their own influence. Or to put it another way, the Judaizers were zealous over the Galatians so that the Galatians would be zealous for them. They can get you going pretty soon. You'll be out there walking on the street with the watchtower and all that. You'll be doing that. That's what they want to do. So that you'll be zealous for them. They had ulterior motives. So that's the artificial loyalty. Now, the authentic loyalty of Paul is in verse 18. He says, first of all, the certainty of Paul's loyalty. He says, it is good to be zealous on the good things always, and not only when I'm present with you. See, he recognizes that he also sought the Galatians. See, he was doing the same thing. He says, these Judaizers are after you. They're trying to get you there. They want to get you to believe what they say and do what they do and be with them all the time. Let them influence you. Then he thought, wait a minute, I do that. I do that too. And we do too. We ought to be just as zealous as the cults. Do what they do, but nothing wrong with doing that, he says. The question is, what's different then about you and the Judaizers? And the answer is zeal. Zeal is not the problem. The reason for the zeal, that's the problem. Is it a zeal for truth? Is it a zeal for the good of those people to whom you are working, when you're witnessing? And Paul says yes to both. When Paul was zealous for them, he had the truth. He gave them the truth. He also did things for their own good. So Paul answers yes on both counts. The Judaizers answer no on both counts. See, they were zealous, but not with the truth. They had the falsehood. And they also have false motives. So they're wrong on both counts. So that's the certainty of Paul's loyalty. He was certainly loyal for them. And the compassion of Paul's loyalty. Here we come to that verse I was talking about. My little children. You can't be mean to little children. If you see them as your little children, you want to hug them. You want to hold them close. That's what he's saying. We talked about this earlier, and he sounds like more like John, the apostle of love, than he does about Paul, the great theologian. You know, sounds like that. But Paul has this side too. He just hasn't shown it so far in Galatians. Now, most of Paul's epistles are doctrine, but you also notice that in Paul's epistles, there's also a practical portion. Ephesians, first three chapters, doctrine. Last three chapters, application. And Colossians 2 and 2. So what he's saying is that the first half is a kind of maybe a scolding or commanding, but then he's saying, now let's do this. Dr. Ryrie calls it the doctrine and duty all through there. All right, so that's the certainty of Paul's loyalty. Now the compassion of Paul's loyalty. And now the check on Paul's loyalty. For whom I labor in birth again until Christ be formed in you. Now, I don't know much about this. I don't know anything about this. I don't believe that anybody would volunteer to go through childbirth a second time for a child. And Paul is saying, I went through the pains of childbirth for you Galatians. Now I'm having to do it again. I'm in the labor of birth again until Christ is born in you. See, he labored over them to bring them the gospel of the grace of God. And he was sick, but he kept on going. He wasn't able to do what he was doing, but he did it. He got up out of bed, you know, a little mind over mattress and get the thing done. That's what he was doing. So now he's saying, I must have the same birth pangs again to bring you to the truth of the gospel a second time. Now, the word formed, until Christ be formed in you, that word formed is a word to refer to something's essential form. In Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, this is Paul talking again, Romans 12, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your logical service. Stop being conformed to this world and go on being transformed. There's that word, formed. Be transformed, metamorphosed. His picture is like a worm that gets into a cocoon and comes out as a butterfly. That's what he's saying. That's why the writer in one of the hymns at the cross refers to such a worm as I. That's a good picture. We are worms coming out into being formed, coming out in the picture and the life of Christ. So he's saying, have real Christ-like character. Remember the Great Commission. I've said this before, I'll say it again. Great Commission is not just to make believers. That's part of it. That's the first part. But it's not the most important part. It's not all there is to it. We're also to make disciples. That's what he's saying. Make disciples of all nations. And you haven't done the job until you've made disciples. Now, making believers, the smaller part of the job. Make disciples. That's conforming to the image of Christ. That's why we were saved. We're saved to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. Romans 8:29. And we are saved to be holy and without blame before him. Ephesians 1:4. So that's the purpose. It's not the purpose just to get your name on the roll and to get to heaven, a little fire insurance. Not that. It's to be like Jesus Christ. Now, in contrast, he says, the Judaizers were just trying to get them to fill a pew, you know, or to be a number that we'll send into headquarters. It'll be in a magazine. Everybody say, how many? All we did. All of that. I was in a church one night, back the church where I was saved. I went back there. Our church wasn't having a meeting that night, so I went back to the home church, and they were having a revival. I went in and sat down in the pew, and one guy says, hey, would you come over and sit in my pew? This is pack a pew night. If anybody asks you, just tell them I asked you to come to church. What? Packing a pew. Well, that's what the Judaizers are doing. Get a notch on my spiritual gun or whatever. They're doing it for the wrong, totally wrong motives. Now, he wants them to have an inside-out faith, not an outside-in. It's impossible to have the outside-in. It's like the fruit of the Spirit. A believer ought to have the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, and all that. Nine of them. All the fruit of the Spirit. How do you get fruit on a tree? That's the figure he's using. How do you get fruit on a tree? Well, let's see, you get a bag of apples and you tie them on the tree. Now you got an apple tree. No, can't do that. Doesn't work. You get the apples from the inside out. You make sure you get an apple tree, number one, and then you do whatever is necessary. Then the apples will come, see, from the inside out. And that's where Christianity ought to be. It ought to be from the inside out. And that's what Paul's saying. Don't try to do it from the outside in. It won't work. He tells them in Philippians chapter 2, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Have the mind of Christ. That's his desire for them and his desire for us. That's the certainty of his loyalty, the compassion of his loyalty, the check on his loyalty. Now, the character of Paul's loyalty, verse 20. I would like to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I have doubts about you. That's shame. See, he wanted to be with them. They're his children in the faith, and he knows that if he were with them, he'd be able to talk to them face-to-face, one-on-one. And he's confident that he could change them. He could move them to the right place, and then he could change his tone about them. Or if maybe some way the word he's been getting is not quite the truth, he'll learn something about that. But in any case, he would change his tone and not be so down on what they're doing. Well, Paul has given us his life. He's shown his love for them, his allegiance for them. Now, we start off with saying, dare to discipline. We need to do that. There needs to be a daring to discipline. We need to tell people, we need to tell ourselves, basically. Tell ourselves, you need to get this done. And if you don't, you're in a position where you need to be having the discipline for others. Dare to discipline. It's necessary. But we also need to bear them in our arms, loving the person who needs the discipline. That's what Paul's after. He's after a change in their lives, only because he wants to see them blossom into the believers, the disciples, that they can be until the Lord comes and takes us all home with him and makes us like Jesus Christ.